Welcome to Interpreter Insights. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. Today, insights into the closeness of those beyond the veil, including deceased loved ones and also angels. This particular broadcast is, of course, supported by the Interpreter Foundation. And although we support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Interpreter Foundation is a separate organization. And because of that, anything I say is strictly my responsibility and not that of the church. I wanted to also mention that each Monday you should not miss a single new episode of the series about the real Brigham Young, produced by Interpreter Foundation and Red Brick Films, called Becoming Brigham. Each one debunks misconceptions and misunderstandings about Brigham Young with facts. Learn who the real Brigham Young was. You should definitely take a look and not miss a single episode. And if you're looking for a fabulous trip, a wonderful experience for the summer, you should consider joining the Interpreter Foundation's fabulous tour of Great Britain, led by Dan Peterson, Chris Fredrickson, and Peter Fagg. Explore LDS church history sites, learn about missionaries who preach the gospel in the UK and their converts, visit amazing cathedrals, palaces, and villages, and be part of local cultural events. It will be a wonderful tour. Space is limited. Book now so you don't miss out. Go to bountifultravel.com, bountifultravel.com, or call them at 801-453-9444. That's 801-453-9444. Now, on with our insights about the closeness of those beyond the veil. I've chosen these particular ones because they're important to me. I have personally interviewed a bit over 700 people who have had near-death experiences, encounters with angels, and seen people from the other side, often family members. It's a particular area of interest for me, and I wanted to share five of those with you for this broadcast. The first one happened to a classmate of mine from high school. This happened after high school. Mario Nyox was an accountant. I say was because he has since passed away. But in July of 2008, he was driving up the canyon. He had gone through a difficult divorce. He was trying to think things through and calm his mind. So he decided to drive up in the summer and see the beautiful flowers up beyond Snowbird by the Alta Ski Resort. And as he came down the canyon, after thinking about his life and the direction that it was headed and just things in general, he headed down as it started to be sunset. And there's a place, if you've been up and down Little Cottonwood Canyon, that's kind of goes like a snake. Some people call it the snake. They did when I was in high school and skied there. And as Mario went around one of these tight turns, there was a deer in the middle of the road, and not being the kind of a guy to hit the deer, he chose the better option for the deer and the worse option for him, and he swerved left and his car went over the edge, and I do mean edge, of a dramatic drop that was not quite straight down, but very, very, very steep over a number of boulders and rocks. And his car was horribly destroyed. that was a total loss, and he himself was badly injured. Mario knew how badly he was injured, and later on, the X-rays showed how bad it was. He had bones broken all over his body. Almost all of his ribs were broken. His back was broken in one place. He had broken arm, broken legs. It was horribly serious. And he knew he could not move, and he did not know exactly what to do. He could only hope that help would come. He didn't know if anyone had seen him as he drove off the little Cottonwood Canyon road. But because it was getting dark, it was an even greater worry for him. And he saw some car lights go by and was afraid that no one had. But then he saw something that was quite fascinating. He was encouraged by seeing two men, and this seemed so strange to him, but he was just so grateful to see them that he didn't quite give it a second thought at the time. There were two men standing at the edge of the road, and they were dressed in white. And Mario wondered who they were, if they were part of a paramedic team or somebody from a hospital or something. And as he was thinking about it, and the pain was growing worse and worse and worse, he concentrated on it to try to deal with it. And then soon afterward, noticed that the two men were by his car. They had made it all the way down to the place where his car was located. And they somehow communicated with him. He said that it wasn't in speech, it was communication by thought, more like mental telepathy. And they told him exactly how to move and how to hold his rib cage and what to do to make sure that he would live through this ordeal, this horrible ordeal. And they reassured him that help was on the way. And indeed, somehow, whether it was because of these two men in white or otherwise, there started to gather at the edge of the road a number of cars. People were making phone calls, and after a while, took over a half an hour, there was a helicopter that came from one of the local hospitals to come get him. And it took quite a time to get Mario out, place him properly on a stretcher, on a board, and get him down. He was in ICU for an extended period of time, and it took him a long time to recover and ultimately go home. Later, when I saw his X-rays, I was just dumbfounded that anyone could live with that many breaks. And to put him back together, he had screws and plates in his back and in various places through his arms and legs. I asked Mario if he knew who those two people in white were, and he said that he thought about it and they knew him. I asked, "How do you know that they knew you?" He said, "I could tell because of their thoughts and the comments that they made that they knew about me." I asked if it was a family member. He said, if it was a deceased family member, he was unaware of who it was. But, and I say who it was, there were two. There were two men in white, and he ultimately settled on the idea that these were two angels who were sent to aid him and to help preserve his life. And one of the things that they told him was that his life's purpose was not yet complete. And one of the somewhat amusing parts of the story is that I asked Mario if he knew what the rest of his life was that wasn't complete. What was this life's purpose that he had to come back for? And he said that he wasn't sure, but he knew that it was something he had to do and that it was very important. And I found that to be fascinating. And also to him, it was very, very comforting because his life seemed to be in a turmoil, having just gone through a divorce. He didn't know if his life was worth living sometimes or what direction it was to go. But after this horrible accident, in some ways, it was actually a blessing because he was reassured that his life still had purpose and meaning. The second encounter with the other side I wanted to mention is a fascinating story. There's a man named Ron Sabrinsky, and Ron worked at the U.S. Borax plant in Boron, California. This event happened in 1996. I doubt anyone listening to this has been out to the U.S. Borax plant in Boron, California. If you go to Barstow, California, and then head off past it, off out into the hot, hot area of California, there is a place where there is a mine where borax, kind of like the 20 Mule Team borax, borax soap, has been mined for decades and decades and decades. As I understand it, the mine has now been acquired by Rio Tinto, but at the time this happened, back in 1996, it was the U.S. Borax plant in Boron, California. One of the ways that this borax was processed is that it involved cleaning it and running it through acid at certain points. And then it was, of course, rinsed and purified. But the gist of it was there were these great big tanks. They would look like a circular water tank with kind of a dome on the top. And due to the fact that acid is very, very corrosive, I don't remember what kind of acid it was, every few years, the interior lining of these tanks, these acid tanks, had to be resurfaced. And it was at one of these resurfacing times for one of these acid tanks that this particular incident happened to Ron Sabrinsky. All of the acid had been all removed and the new lining had been placed on the tank. It had been inspected a number of times. Ron Sabrinsky had gone back in for one final look over, and apparently, for whatever reason, everyone thought that he was out and that it was time to start filling up the tank with acid again. And he was not dressed in fancy clothes. He wasn't wearing any kind of a mask because everything had been done. All the resurfacing was complete and there was no acid in there. When the acid was turned on and began to pour into the plant, immediately the air was filled with vapor that made it extremely hard for him to even breathe. He tried by lifting his shirt sleeve up over his nose, but he was immediately coughing and choking. He had to close his eyes. He couldn't tell where he was. He thought maybe he knew the direction of the door, but he wasn't sure. And then, in an instant, everything became calm. And Ron said that he heard, above all the din of the acid coming in and all the chaos in his mind, a quiet voice that he believed was the voice of an angel that said to him, "Come this way." And he followed the voice and quickly went towards the door and began pounding hard on the door with some of the tools that he had in a tool belt. And people heard him and immediately opened the door that had been shut and got him out of there. He suffered some serious burns. His lungs were damaged, but all in all, he was in pretty good shape. And the fascinating part about this is that he also, similar to the story I just told about Morayo Nyok, did not know who this voice was. I asked him if it was God or Jesus. He said no. It seemed like it was an angel, it was a person, but it was not someone that I knew. Nevertheless, Ron was invigorated because of that. And similarly to Mario, he felt like his life had purpose. For those who are involved in some kind of a miracle, it's often something that changes your life dramatically, sometimes forever. The next story I wanted to bring up is one that does not involve an angel, but it does involve a miracle. In 1965, a distant relative of mine, a woman from Arizona named Deanne Shelley, was in the Oakland Temple with her husband. And she had gone through a temple session, which was near and dear to her because she didn't know how many opportunities she would have to do that. She had been stricken for many years with multiple sclerosis, and it had been getting worse and worse. For several years, she was able to get by with a cane and then crutches. And finally, she was in a wheelchair and she wound up going through the temple. She thought maybe for one of the last times in the Oakland Temple in 1965. And as she went through the temple, she felt its peace and the wonderful spirit that's there. And as she came out of the doors to exit the temple after changing back into street clothes, she had this peculiar sensation. She described it like electricity going through her from her head to her toes. Every part of her body felt like it had electricity, although it was not a bad sensation. It felt like energy going through her. And she knew as it happened, she just knew that her multiple sclerosis was gone. And she was able to walk thereafter for the first time in many, many years. That's a wonderful story that brought many additional years of happiness to Deanne and her husband that they thought they would not ever be able to experience because of her very, very difficult disease. The next story I wanted to bring up is really, to me, quite dramatic because it involved a very difficult choice. There were four members of a family: wife Karen, husband Derek, daughter Liza, and a son Danny. And they were at Yuba Reservoir in March in 2000, if I remember correctly. And this was a very dramatic experience. When Karen described it, it was hard for her to do because it was so traumatic. In early March, you often can't even get to the reservoir or want to unless you're bundled up. But this was a day where, although there were only a very, very few boats on Yuba Reservoir, they wanted to test out the work that had been done by Derek on a boat that their family had acquired and that he had been doing work on. The boat worked flawlessly. They drove around and the kids were excited and it was just a wonderful event. They pulled the boat up into a bay. And if you've been to Yuba Lake, some of the shoreline is not so hospitable, but this particular place was kind of a sandy area where you could get out and walk around, and it was quite nice. So they pulled the boat up onto the shore and went up the beach a little ways to have some lunch, which Karen had packed. And as they began eating lunch, they noticed that somehow, probably because of the wind and perhaps because the rope that held the boat was not tied securely, the boat was beginning to be blown by the wind out into the bay at a fairly decent clip. Knowing that the water was cold, Derek told his wife Karen to stay there, and she held their two little kids, Liza and Danny. There was a brief little struggle back and forth about who should swim for the boat because Derek wasn't a great swimmer, and Karen had been on swim team in high school, and she was a very competent swimmer. But Derek left, and he kicked off his shoes and swam out towards the boat as fast as he could swim. And after a few minutes, it became painfully obvious to Karen that Derek wasn't going to make it because the boat was going out further and further at about the same rate that he was swimming. And finally, he decided to give up on the boat and try to swim back, but he could not do it. He was completely tired. And so Karen, seeing the danger, kicked off her shoes and told Liza and Danny to stay at the shore. And they were just little, like 4 and 6 years old. That was it. And so she dashes down the beach and dives into the water and swam out with all her might to her husband. And about halfway towards her husband, she stopped swimming for a second to get her bearings, and her husband was still trying to hang on. And she said, "I'll be there, I'll get you." And then she took a quick look back to make sure that the children were there at the side, like she had told them to be on the shore, the side of the lake, and they weren't. They were crying and they were holding hands and they were walking into the water to follow their mom. And with that, Karen had to make a split decision. Would she lose her husband or would she lose her children? And she chose her children. She swam back fast and she was able to get Liza and Danny out of the water, although they had swallowed some, but Derek drowned. Her husband passed away. This was a terrible blow to Karen and her family. They went from a happy family to a widow and two kids who were traumatized. Karen had difficulty sleeping. She had nightmares. She wondered about her choice, if she had made the right choice. If she had gone on and saved Derek, would the children have perhaps made it? But in her heart, she knew they wouldn't have because she had just barely made it back in time. And as she went through this turmoil for weeks and weeks and weeks, one night, in the middle of the night, She woke up with a start and said she was just wide awake. And there at the foot of her bed, she saw her husband, Derek. And he was smiling and he was shining and he was happy. And he smiled at her and said, "Don't worry, everything will be all right. Everything will be all right." And with that, he smiled and was gone. Even though it still wasn't much easier to raise two children as a young widow, Karen knew that her husband was well and on the other side, and that he still loved her and was waiting for her at the day that she would pass on herself, and that they were still a forever family. That's one of the choice stories that I've heard in my life. The final story I have for this segment of Interpreter Insights is one also from a little bit south in Utah. There's a gentleman who I've known for several decades now, named Vern Swanson. For a long time, he was the curator, if that's the right word. He was the guy in charge at the Springfield Museum of Art. Vern's a wonderful guy. He was involved in acquiring Russian art and a bunch of other art from amazing local artists and artists from different places around the world for the Springfield Museum of Art. Fabulous, fabulous service he did, and he's just a wonderful man. He had a bachelor's degree from BYU, master's from University of Utah in art, and then went on to teach art at Auburn University. And while he was at teaching at Auburn University, this was in April of 1975, his wife and very young son, Brett, were coming back from a family event, her side of the family, that was in Cardston, Canada. And as they were passing on their way, that they had to drive, they were, starving family without much money, trying to get by. And so Vern's wife and son had driven all the way from Auburn University in the South, all the way up to Canada. And on their way back, they encountered a horrible head-on collision. She, two cars collided. It was a head-on, and only one person survived, and it was not his wife, and it was not his son, Brett. Vern was devastated. And it was particularly devastating for Vern because when the funeral happened, the accident was so bad, it was a closed casket. And there weren't even two coffins. Brett was so young that both he and Vern's wife were placed in one casket. And so it kind of seemed surreal, and he kept hoping and expecting that he might see his wife and his son again, even though intellectually he knew they were gone. His love for them just would not allow him to let go. He was having a difficult time, went into depression, was having a hard time coping with life and wondering what was to happen in the future. Ultimately, something happened to him that was similar to what happened to Karen that I talked about in the prior story. One night, Vern woke up and he saw a bright, beautiful light at the foot of his bed. And in that light was his wife and son. And it was a beautiful reunion. Vern was able to talk to his wife, and she was able to communicate to him. Again, this was more like thought communications, telepathy, if you will. And what Vern learned from that was that he needed to move on with his life and that all would be well. But one of the tidbits that he told about this story and about the nature of people who come and visit someone from the other side, he said, "My favorite actress was someone who I thought was absolutely beautiful." And his favorite actress was someone that he loved to see her in the movies. And ultimately, what happened was that he was comparing his wife with his favorite actress, Grace Kelly. He just thought she was absolutely amazing and beautiful. And he said that in her best day, at her absolute peak, Grace Kelly didn't hold a candle to how beautiful his wife looked to him as she appeared at the foot of his bed. She was glorious. She was bright. She was just absolutely spectacular. And that is the nature of people who are on the other side. They are not subject to the ills and difficulties and trials and traumas of this life anymore. And they look radiant and beautiful and spectacular. And they are also very aware of many things that are happening in this life, as we learn from every one of these five stories. Those on the other side, our Heavenly Father, Jesus, loved ones, guardian angels who may be assigned to someone, all are intimately aware of our lives and the things that we do daily, which should bring us all a great deal of comfort that even though life is hard, it has purpose. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Interpreter Insights. Please give me a five-star review if you would. Tell your friends about this Interpreter Insights podcast and join me again next time.